Movie buff specialist Phil and John are back, and today we are breaking down Iron Man 3 and The Nun 2. Just a bunch of sequels doing sequel stuff, right, John? I guess that's the best way to put it at this point.
Definitely the best way to sum up both of these movies. Maybe I would put in a bunch of sequels with a lot of potential kind of squandering them.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that The Nun 2 had any potential. I was not privy to The Nun 1 until this past week. I knew it existed. Yeah. I just never watched it. And then Iron Man 3, Shane Black's name all over it, wrote, directed, all that stuff. It's got some Shane Black elements to it, but it was always going to be what it was going to be, right? We're starting with The Nun 2. It's almost spooky season. Next week we'll be doing A Haunting in Venice. So that's kind of a spooky one, but not really, right? I mean, it's halfway there. And you know, in a couple weeks we'll have The Exorcist Believer coming out. So that could be good. We shall see. As somebody who I watched the first Conjuring, one of my all-time favorite horror movies. I really love it. I love the pacing. I love the build of the story. I love the design. I think it's a beautiful to look at movie. I think that the scares in it are so earned, with the clapping hands inside the, when they're playing the clapping game, and then inside the whatever, the armoire, whatever you want to call it. I think that's awesome. The person on top of it, the movie's not just jump scares, right? Like it's scares you earn. There's a couple jump scares, but I actually love that the first Conjuring ends on a fake out jump scare. You think the jump is coming, it builds your anticipation. It just cuts to black. You think it's going to happen. And that movie earns what it does. Just enjoyable. For a big budget horror movie, you don't see movies that come out like that. I rewatched that actually after watching the first Nun, gave it 4 stars. The Nun might be the biggest piece of shit I've ever seen in my entire life.
It's so bad. It's so bad.
I gave the first Nun 1 star, and I think I was generous, but then I start to consider, like, what is a half star movie? Like, I claim that the 2001 Planet of the Apes is a 0-star movie, but on Letterboxd, they make you rate it at least a half star in order for it to count. A 0-star movie, Planet of the Apes and Lady in the Water are the only two that I would give that. I mean, if you're watching a Hallmark movie or something like that, what is a 0-star movie, right? Like, it has to be a movie where there's expectations and it's a disaster. A half star movie, those are movies like Chicken Little, Hillbilly Elegy. Movies that should be good and are so bad because they just take the laziest way. And then a 1-star movie, the difference between that and a half star movie isn't much. I'm probably being generous giving Nun 1 star. The second Nun was better. Is it actually worthy of the ratings we gave it? I don't know, but it's better. John, did you rewatch the first Nun prior to watching The Nun 2 this week?
I had also never seen The Nun until this week.
Okay.
And I watched it last week. And my thought was, oh no, what have we gotten ourselves into? Because it was horrendous. This movie. Yeah. And like, I knew, like, there were jokes about this movie. There's that like really famous Chords video where he talks like about how bad this movie is and how it's kind of wrecking modern horror. And the entire movie is just based off this idea. This is a scary looking character.
Yep.
And it was so bad. I didn't know what to expect. And I'm sitting here thinking, oh my God, we committed to watching the sequel to this movie. What is this going to be when we go see it this weekend? I was pleasantly surprised, in all honesty.
Pleasantly surprised because it didn't feel like a total waste of an hour and 52 minutes.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I'm pretty sure I wrote in my Letterboxd review, I gave it 2.5 stars. And I don't know if I was doing that strictly because of how much better it was than the first movie. Or, you know, just because that's what I actually thought about it. But it was actually an enjoyable time. It was an enjoyable theater-going experience for me. I live in a university town, right? So we've been a little scant when it comes to, like, moviegoers. I went at like 9:45 on a Sunday night or Saturday night, and like the theater was packed. There are people there, and it's been a very long time since I've gone to one of these like mainstream horror movies, these type of horror movies that bring the crowd out, that everyone's there. And I forgot how fun it is to sit in a theater watching this type of movie with those people. You know, the you have the screamers, you have the criers, you have the people who just like exclaim things as something happens. You know, the, oh no, don't do that, people.
Mm-hmm.
This type of movie is elevated in a theater setting because you get an audience reaction. And you and I are people who are very adamant. We don't like audience reaction stuff and like people commenting on movies. This is the type of movie that really benefits from it.
Yeah, I mean, I think like horror and comedy in general benefit from a theater setting because like when you hear other people laughing, you're more inclined to laugh. You know, if you're not, like, that's why I don't watch stand-up, because if I sit there and I watch stand-up alone, I'm like, this isn't, like, I don't find this funny. And I feel like I'm being, like, it's weird for me to be told jokes to. I don't like jokes being told to me. I like more of, like, witty whatever. So comedy, though, you hear more people laughing. Horror, you hear people get scared. Horror, though, is different for me because I almost get annoyed. And I watched the Cords video before this because you sent it to me. And I felt like he was speaking my language. I almost get annoyed when people get scared at stuff that is so unbelievably predictable. My wife and I, we went to Halloween Horror Nights. And Halloween Horror Nights, like for anybody who hasn't gone to it, it's literally you just walk through a haunted house and things just jump out at you the entire time. Every time you hit a corner, something is going to jump out at you. You know that every single time you hit a corner, something is going to jump out at you. But it's loud noises, there's people in front of you. Every now and then you get like a cool looking thing, but it really is just jumping out. My wife jumped every time. And at the beginning it was like, oh, hold my hand, this, that. And I'm like, no, I'm not going to, because you're literally, it's like literally annoying at this point. Because every time we hit a corner, you're jumping so high. And it's like, did you really not expect that to happen? Did you not see that person coming? And I get it's a natural instinct sometimes. But when you have the gasp that's going along with it. And that's how I felt with the first Nun. I think your taste is your taste. The music you like is the music you like. The movies you like are the movies you like. If you think The Nun is a good movie, I do think less of you. I truly do. Like, I'm sorry. I really, like, I'm sorry. But that's where, like, The Nun 2, I could get on board with it. I went and saw it on Saturday? No, I went and saw it on...
You saw it on Monday.
Monday, that's right. Yeah, I saw it on Monday. My days are all mixed up. So I saw it on Monday morning. It was me and an old guy in the theater. The old guy had a, you know, he didn't really react much. I didn't really react much. Every time I was like, oh, here comes a jump scare. The one thing I at least appreciated with The Nun 2 is that at the beginning, they do try to set up the story. I don't hate the story. It felt like they were trying to make amends for the disaster that was the first story. The third act of this movie is horrible, which we'll talk about. But the first Nun is literally just loud noise, loud noise, loud noise, loud noise. Isn't this scary because it's a loud noise? Like, no, it's annoying. Stop. I'm not jumping anymore because I'm just frustrated. And I hate the trend in new horror movies. It's okay when it happens sometimes, but I hate the trend in new horror movies where it's person standing, walking down a hall, nothing behind them.
Yeah.
They turn the camera to be their point of view, and then they turn the camera back, and there's somebody behind them. It's my least favorite trend. You know it's going to be there, and that's not frightening. It's not scary. And, like, the people who still get scared by that stuff, sure, be scared at whatever you want to be scared at. But if your recommendation to me is a horror movie where that's the horror, I'm out. I'm totally out. I'm totally done on it. Because then I think about a movie like It Follows, which is a perfect movie, in my opinion. And that's a movie where a lot of it is that kind of thing of this person wasn't there or whatever. But what that movie does such a great job of establishing early on is you don't know who the real people are and who the person, the follower is. And so that scene on the beach in It Follows is one of my favorite horror movie scenes, period. Mm-hmm. Because it is so brilliantly executing a trope, but then using what our knowledge of the movie is to change that. The Nun 2 doesn't do that. Everything that happens in The Nun 2 is exactly what you would expect to happen. And that's what I love so much about The Conjuring, is that The Conjuring, it subverts your expectations. There's so many non-scares that when the scares happen, they almost catch you off guard. Whereas in The Nun and The Nun 2, every time you think there's going to be a jump scare, there's a jump scare. Every time you think there's going to be a loud noise, there's a loud noise. Every time you think that there's going to be a goat demon thing that runs around the hallways for no apparent reason, there is. There is. It's just always there.
Yes.
I will not revisit these two movies. And it's a shame because it really does weaken the Conjuring universe, which I've only seen these three movies of. I didn't even see Conjuring 2. So,
yeah, I mean, there's only 8 movies in this universe now.
Jesus. And I say that not smartassly, right? Because in this, what is it? In the first Nun, what is it? Holy shit, the holiest. I almost punched my
TV. That was a line.
I almost ripped this TV right here off the wall and smashed it on the ground. I would have used it as a write-off because I deserve to smash it if I am technically working doing that. So my God, like somebody wrote that. Somebody actually wrote that, John.
Yeah. I know. But I'm going to disagree on the point you just made because I do think there is, I think, yes, a lot of the scares are pretty telegraphed and a lot of like, you know, the appearances of the nun and stuff are very telegraphed. You know when it's going to happen. I thought it was handled a lot better in this movie where it was a lot more subtle. It wasn't like, oh my God, there's the nun all of a sudden. It's like, is that the nun? Okay. The nun's coming into focus. And it forced you to kind of look in scenes for Valak in the background more than in the first movie. But I will say there is one scene where I was sure a jump scare was coming and it never did. And it was the best scene of the entire movie. And that is the scene where Maurice goes into the bell tower looking for Sophie after the headmistress has died. So Sophie's already encountered the nun at this point. Like we've already had the, like the hallway scene and everything. And we are, I mean, we as the audience are well aware that Maurice is possessed by Valak the entire time. And Maurice goes, find Sophie at the top of this, this bell tower. It's her hidden spot. And he's just like calmly talking to her through the fact that like, you know, this woman who's been in her life for most of her life just died and like what that means and stuff. And the entire time you are sitting there as an audience member being like, this guy's the nun. The nun's just going to come and like kill Sophie at any moment now. And it never comes. And it is so, it's just exactly like that. That was the point where I was like, is this movie actually good? And then the third act happens.
Yeah, the third act is atrocious. I could not believe how bad the third act was. With all the stuff that happened, it was let's throw every bit of nonsense that we can at the wall and see what sticks. None of it had any rhyme or reason, anything like that. And like I will say, like early on in this movie, I mean, the burning guy, like that was silly, goofy, whatever. But like the nun's hand popping out from behind the corner is kind of creepy, all of that. I do think the problem is, though, once you see something once, it's not really scary anymore. And you see the nun 9,000 times in the first nun, and every time you see her, it goes, rah! Like, oh my God, that's the loud noise again. It's absolutely infuriating. But, like, there are certain things that can be creepy. But if you become overexposed to it, it's no longer creepy. It's the same reason why things don't get like very rarely do comedies get funnier the more you watch them. Yeah, you appreciate them and you love them. Like I'll laugh every time I watch Step Brothers or Anchorman. But that doesn't mean that like it's not like I'm hearing the joke for the first time. I'm like as I'm watching it the second time, I'm laughing because it's silly. The nun is so visualized or whatever, so seen in these movies that it's just like, whatever, I get it. It's the nun. There's the nun. There's the standing down a hallway looking kind of creepy. Like it's the same thing every time. And then when they show the demon goat thing, who the hell cares? Who cares? Like that's not creepy because I don't understand why it's, I don't understand why it's there. And it's not unsettling in a way like Inland Empire, where Inland Empire with the clown face is one of the most terrifying scenes ever because it's so unsettling, even though you don't understand it. There needs to be some understanding of what's going on for it to be creepy. Otherwise, I was kind of laughing because I'm like, there's a guy in that suit running around in this scene. And like, that's what he did this year. That was his acting role this year.
Nope.
It made me kind of laugh.
I wasn't kind of laughing. I legitimately burst out laughing when I saw this character for the first time. Bad. Legitimately, it was the funniest thing in the world. I was just like, why is Black Phillip in this movie all of a sudden? I get it. Like, it's set up. They talk about the goat, and then the goat disappears from the stained glass, whatever. I just rewatched The Conjuring 2, so I'm more versed with the powers Valak has, and Valak does have the power not just to take the shape of something, but also to manifest things in order to, like, prey on people's fears. So that's clearly what's going on here. It would have been nice if that was kind of mentioned in this movie at all, but that's fine. Whatever, I get it. But this goat person, like this devil, whatever it is, so funny. So funny. Yeah. Especially the point where it like gores a kid through the door to the chapel. Because if you just picture it with these horns this goat has, that means this goat like just like backed up, like put its head down and rammed its head through this door to gore this child. And it's so funny. And again, that's kind of why I enjoyed this, because I'm just sitting there having a good time. And there are people behind me just like pooping their pants, scared.
Yeah, I mean, the girl who gets stabbed with that, I get she's like the little bad girl. Is she fine after that? Like, do we ever get like a closure on like whether she's good or like just like got like killed and all? Also, like, went through, probably hit some, like, main major arteries or something, but she's chilling, whatever, no big deal. It's so bad.
I wanted that little girl to die so much, though.
Wow. Wow.
I know. I'm a terrible person, I guess. But as soon as those kids started picking on Sophie, I was like, man, I hope the nun gets them. That didn't happen. I was very disappointed.
Yeah. I mean, there was no way they were going to kill the kids, because that would require this to actually be a real horror movie, right?
I know. I know, but I mean, a man could dream. A man could dream, because like there are elements of real horror movie in here. And I think like one of the best things this movie does is kind of walk that line between how much does Maurice know what's going on? Like, when is Valak taking control of Maurice and stuff? And like, I will admit, the stupidest thing is like, Maurice like essentially having a seizure whenever Valak takes possession, and it was a little confusing towards the end, like, okay, is Valak in like three places at once now, because we have Valak like floating in the sky, we have Maurice running around, and we have a demon goat chasing kids. It's confusing. But it's so much more, everything's more explicable than in the first movie. And like, I just enjoyed it so much more because of that, because there was motive. That was something that lacked. That is actually something that kind of lacks in a lot of these movies.
Yeah.
Let me tell you, Conjuring 2, no motive in that movie. Doesn't make sense. The Nun, literally zero logic in that universe, in that movie whatsoever. Yeah. But at least in this one, like, where it's established, there's this idea that like Valak's going after the Eyes of St. Lucy, because it's a holy relic that'll...
They established that pretty late in the movie.
They do, but at least they established it. That's like, true. At least there's something there explaining it. There's like, we kind of get an idea. It retcons why Irene is involved in the first movie in the first place, because that never made any sense.
Yeah.
Like, there was a valiant effort here to connect these films a lot more than they were before.
I do think, too, a lot of times when it comes to spiritual horror, they all try to do the Exorcist thing of, like, it's random. Yeah. The demon just chose. The devil just chose. And it's like, okay, that worked in The Exorcist, because The Exorcist was a first of its kind, one of a kind movie. That can't be the reason every time.
No.
Like there needs to be more to it for it to be scary. Especially, people are becoming less religious nowadays. Like, back in 1973, when The Exorcist came out, I would bet, and I'm probably, maybe I'm over exaggerating here, but I would bet like 80% of the North American population was still religious. And in Europe, it was probably significantly more. I think it still is significantly more in Europe. But now that I think religion, you know, and you know, who I went to unright.com to find this information, but like, I think religion's at the lowest it's been in a very long time. And so it's not as frightening for people to be like, ooh, like the devil's going to like possess you. when you saw it happen to Reagan in 1973, it was terrifying. When I see it happen to Frenchie in this movie, I'm like, oh yeah, that sucks. Looks like he ate like bad wings or something, you know, like it's nonsense. And so that is this is an oversaturated market so badly right now.
Yeah.
And they all have the same motive, which is there is none. And I think the first Conjuring, what I liked about that is there was more of a motive. The kid dies, but you know, it's the witch who is trying to kill like the relatives. Like, that's really good. I like that. I'm into that. Even if it's a convoluted plot and we won't know what the demon actually wants, give me some sort of purpose. Lie about it. Just do it. And The Nun 2 does at least try to do that a little bit. Mm-hmm. The problem with The Nun 2, though, is even though the story is trying to be good, why are we telling the story about like three total, like the locations? It's all spread out.
That was really
going on. That's a problem.
Yeah, it was a problem because I feel like, I don't know. I feel like I really enjoyed the like kind of like Indiana Jones vibe that we got from like the Irene storyline. I really enjoyed the Frenchie storyline in the school where you like knew scary things were happening and stuff, but it was too disjointed. It was too all over the place because they were in separate places, because there's our established characters. But like, let's be honest, is everyone who is going to see this movie having seen The Nun, like the first one? Is anyone who sees this movie going to remember these characters from the first one? If you and I hadn't just watched this movie, would we have had any idea who these characters were?
Yeah. No, I wouldn't have. No.
Yeah. And now you're just like following the story. It's like, okay, why is this uninvolved? And granted, I think the funniest thing in this entire movie is in the convent at the beginning when Irene's like comes into their room and the one nun's like explaining the first movie. Mm-hmm. And Irene just has this face of like, could you not? It's so funny. I thought it was hilarious. And like other people don't think it's funny because they hadn't just watched the first nun and thought about how bad it was. But it's these little things that I do appreciate in this movie. It's just, it's a bit too disjointed. Like you said, like it's just all over the place. Not to mention how disjointed it is from the entire franchise.
Yeah, it doesn't make any sense. I mean, those types of exposition scenes drive me insane. And I think what frustrates me with horror is there's a lot of good horror writers out there. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people who can write good horror. And I know them. You know, you haven't seen it up on the big screen yet. But I think what frustrates me so much, and Cord says it in his review of the first Nun, is it's just a studio takes a franchise that we've heard of, throws a first-time director into it, and just tries to shill out money. That's all it is. And so what happens is this is what mainstream horror is now, because this is what has been shoved down your throat. You're forcing down people's throats horror movies that don't make you think. And that's why the horror movies that do make you think, The House of the Devil, It Follows, The Descent to an extent, they get blown over because they're not this type of jump scare. Even in The Babadook, that movie's phenomenal. The one scene of the jump scare in The Babadook is terrifying. Because the whole time you're scared of the Babadook. That's the difference. And so it frustrates me that this is what horror is now, because it's not what it has to be. And every time a horror movie comes out, you can almost guarantee 95% of the time it's going to have a 30% or lower on Rotten Tomatoes. Mm-hmm. And these critics, I don't really give a crap what they say. But it's just, this movie is going to be bad before they make it. You know it's going to be bad. So why is this what we're making instead of trying to give Ty West a bigger audience?
Because it's cheap and it brings in money. Like, that's just what it comes down to, right? Like, that's...
But a lot of these movies are cheap. I mean, what's his name who does Hereditary and Midsommar and stuff? I mean, those are pretty cheap.
Yeah, they are. And like... It's really interesting because if you look at my reviews for the entire Conjuring movie, like all the Conjuring movies, I talk about how they are horror movies of a bygone era because they feel a lot more like those like early aughts, late 90s horror movies that are, and trust me, I just watched Event Horizon today too, and so I have an idea about these 90s horror movies right now, that they're like, they're so focused on jump scares, not focused on atmosphere, and they're not focused on this idea of like building a theme into the, like, what makes this scary. Mm-hmm. Is one of those things that, like, a lot of common horror movies don't have. You look at something like The Blair Witch Project. What makes it scary? This could happen to me. Mm-hmm. I could end up getting lost in the woods, and who knows what happens at that point. Mm-hmm. You look at something like Hereditary, or like any of like these Ari Aster or these like elevated ones nowadays that are dealing with
Ari Aster, sorry.
Right? Yeah. And dealing with like this theme of grief. I saw someone post in a Letterboxd group on Facebook today that there's too many horror movies about grief today. And I'm like, have you watched a horror movie? They are all about grief. That is literally the premise of most horror movies. But then we have these like mainstream ones, these ones that the studios put out. They prey on people who are looking for something familiar, who know what they're going for, and like get scared by jump scares, right?
Yeah.
And like, this has been, we stretch back to like the 80s with like slasher flicks. That's what we're doing here, right? But it doesn't have the camp of like those slasher flicks, which made them so good. Instead, we have these movies that are predicated on the idea of, oh, this imagery is scary, and if we put a very loud sound with it, we're going to get a reaction from the audience and they're going to think they're scared. But most of the time in these movies, what you're reacting to is a startling sound. It's your, it's your, fight innate, or flight.
Yeah, it's your innate reaction. That's all.
Yeah. It's just you reacting to something, because when you hear something loud, you look around, because loud things tend to demonstrate dangerous things.
Yeah.
You look around, your body is built in a way where it responds to these loud sounds. That's why these jump scares feel so unearned, when they're accompanied with a sting.
Yeah. Well, and I don't want to talk about this movie too much longer, because I want to cut it at the half hour, but I do want to comment on a couple of those things. In The Conjuring, which I just rewatched Monday, I can only remember one jump scare, and I love it. It's the scare where they, what?
It's the cabinet scare, right?
Yeah. Yeah, when she's up on top of it. It is brilliant. It is terrifying. Everything else in that movie is very moody, and it's visceral, and that's why you remember it. And I think about in The Descent, there's one jump scare in that movie, and it's the first time you see that damn creature, and it's terrifying. Yeah. And then there's also the jump scare where the thing goes through her head, which is startling, but whatever. So there's a couple cheap ones there. But the thing with a movie like The Nun is, the people who are coming out of the movie being like, like, all my heart, ask them then after that to tell you what happened in that movie. They can't do it. They cannot tell you what happened in that movie, because nothing that happened in the movie actually meant anything to them. It didn't resonate with them at all. It was just a couple jump scares and then go, oh, that's it. But so what? I mean, that happens every day. You turn the corner and you see something that's out of place. You go, oh, what? Then you forget about it. It doesn't matter. And that's what's so dumb. And you brought up a great point. Why is the Blair Witch Project scary? I look at so what I'm trying to put together, my top 50 horror movies by the time we get done with October, so that I can state what my letterbox is. And I know it's probably not a horror movie, but Requiem for a Dream is one of my favorite horror movies of all time, because that movie is flat out terrifying, and it's something that could happen to anybody. With The Nun 2 and The Nun, it doesn't matter which one. What is scary about these? Because they aren't relevant to anybody's life. What, a creepy woman standing with a pale face is scary? Why is that scary? Why is that scary? There's nothing scary about it. And it drives me insane, because you can't relate to it. The Exorcist was scary because that could be your daughter. That could be you. That's what's scary about that. Now they try to do, oh, this is based on real events. Yeah, okay. F you, as they say. F you.
Yeah, I understand the popularity of them. I understand that people like cheap thrills. That's just what it comes down to. People like cheap thrills. And we should be prepared for more movies like this coming out of a writer's strike, because these are the type of movies that are going to be made, because they are so easy, cheap to make, and they bring in money, because people love these. People like being scared. And like, even if it's an artificial fear, they like it. We thrive for it. That's why I love horror movies. I love the uneasiness that they make me feel. Does The Nun 2 scare me? No. But did I hate it? No, because at least it tried to do something different than the first one.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't hate it until the third act. With the third act, I could have given this 1.5 stars, but I liked the opening enough, and it felt like they were trying to be different. And there's some laziness, but my expectations were so low that, honestly, this might have been the 4-star version compared to what I thought it was going to be. So.
Exactly. Yeah.
The hell do I know? All right, let's jump over to Iron Man 3. I don't need to talk about The Nun 2 probably ever again for as long as I live. Iron Man 3, written and directed by Shane Black. Who else got the writing credit on that? It's not
just like five writers on this, isn't there?
I think that the movie actually only pops up with two. Okay. It's Shane Black and Drew Pierre.
Okay, yeah.
Who also wrote Rogue Nation, Fast and the Furious, Hobbs and Shaw, Hotel Artemis. Those are some,
like, not terrible movies to be have writing credits on.
Yeah, not bad. So Iron Man 3 has so many Shane Black inspirations. I mean, I die laughing at the beginning of this because I'm just like, dude, this is kiss, kiss, bang, bang.
Yes, absolutely.
You're trying to do, you want to know how I got to the party? Well, this is how I got to the party. Like, it's literally kiss, kiss, bang, bang.
Yeah.
What do you feel about Iron Man 3 as a whole? I see that you gave it 2.5 stars.
I did.
But what do you feel about Iron Man 3 as a whole? And how did this change this on this viewing?
So I remember I saw Iron Man 3 in theaters back when it was released, as I have with almost every Marvel movie. And I remember being really receptive to it. Now, at this point, I had already seen Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. I already knew who Shane Black was. I understood his type of his brand of comedy and like that dark satire he puts in things. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed this. I remembered it being way more heavier on the like PTSD stuff than it was ended up actually being, because it turns out not a lot on that in this movie, and I enjoy it up until we get to the third act. I think the third act of this movie was terrible.
Isn't that always what happens?
Yeah, I mean it has the Marvel third act problem where it's a big action sequence and like what's going on anymore.
Yeah. No, this is the so I liked all the Shane Black stuff. And I think that's why I gave this 2.5 and not lower. And actually I was ready to give this 3 stars until the god awful.
I wasn't too until the third act.
Yeah, the third act is so bad. The whole Gwyneth Paltrow getting whatever thing in her and stuff. My biggest problem with this movie though, by the end of it, is what are the rules? What are the rules of this movie, John? Like, what is this fire thing? And I'm not going to use superhero terms, kids. So don't think I'm going to start like calling things by what they are. What is this fire thing? What are Tony Stark's robots able to do? Why is Gwyneth Paltrow able to be like healed from this? Why is everybody else having the reaction they're having to it? Why is it kind of like ruining their brains while like just turning them into like killing machines, even though it's making them stronger and superhuman and whatever? But then Guy Pearce is still really intelligent and hasn't completely gone totally like bozo. What are the laws? What did I miss?
I don't think anyone was going crazy. I think they were all very like sane and following their own ambitions still.
I don't feel like they were.
Yeah, no. I think they were. And I think they were just feeling indebted to the person who let them grow their limbs back.
Yeah, because for me, it felt like they were all working so much for Guy Pearce. Mm. And it felt like every one of them, and maybe this is just the superhero issue, but it felt like every single one of them was like, I have this power. I got my limb back. And now I have lost all ethics. I am ready to kill people because that's what the guy who gave me this limb back wants me to do. And I just think that like nobody thought like, hey, let me use this for good.
Well, I'm not one to really like be able to comment on this, but one would assume that since these are all veterans who lost their limbs, who were living in an American system that doesn't really respect veterans all that much, despite pretending to, and doesn't provide support for them in the ways that they need, right? I could see myself being pretty pissed off at the system after that.
But aren't they just, they're kind of attacking everyone.
I mean, so it's, I think it becomes established that at one point they weren't trying to attack everyone and they were just blowing up. And that's the whole reason they created the Mandarin persona in the first place, was to make it seem like it was targeted when it really wasn't. They're just kind of covering their butts to make it like not seem like these people are just randomly exploding. But like, I definitely understand where you're coming from, because I mean, at one point Guy Pierce breathes fire.
Yeah.
Which like, is fantastic. So it's a fantastic reference for comics, because it's definitely a Fing Fang Foom reference, which we're getting into like the Mandarin as a whole, right? Like he has this mystical tendrics. The reason why we don't actually get the Mandarin in this movie is because that character is incredibly racist. Incredibly racist. Built on a lot of racial stereotypes of Chinese culture, and serves a dragon called Fing Fang Foom. And that is one of Iron Man's biggest adversaries in all comics. So getting a Fing Fang Foom shout out here is cool for people who know it. Otherwise, you're just like, why did Guy Pierce just breathe dragon? Breathe fire.
And I feel like the rules all fell apart in the third act. And then the other thing that drove me crazy, and maybe I just missed something while watching it, maybe I need to be a more focused watcher. This kid that he runs into.
Yes.
What is this? Explain to me how this is even in the realm of reasonable, even in a superhero movie.
It's hard, because I remember liking this kid a lot more the first time I watched this movie. And it was because of like this like carefree thing, or like the carefree approach he had to help Tony. Again, this is also my misremembering that this kid actually helped Tony through his PTSD somehow. Mm-hmm. Instead, this kid is here just to trigger Tony's PTSD.
Yeah.
And like, yeah, you're right. There's no point to this character. It doesn't really accomplish anything. Tony doesn't.
And he knows everything, though, so it's great for exposition.
Yeah. It's convenient. Mm-hmm. That he's in this small town in Tennessee where someone happened to explode.
Like, geez. How convenient.
Yeah.
Yeah, that drove me nuts. The Ben Kingsley thing, so far my favorite part of any of the Marvel movies we've watched. I love that.
Like, as a whole?
Yeah, so far out of the ones we've watched, I love that Ben Kingsley, because this was so Shane Black. This felt like something. Yes. This felt like Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. This felt like The Nice Guys. It's that reveal that you're not expecting in a superhero movie, which is that he's not actually the big bad, that he's just kind of a loser. And I thought that was fun. Because the whole movie, they're really leaning into the terrorist thing. And I was seeing this. I'm like, man, to call him the Mandarin and have it be played by Ben Kingsley is kind of messed up, huh? Like,
it's like casting Ben Kingsley as Mahatma Gandhi or something like that, right?
Exactly. But then when it's revealed that Ben Kingsley is like
Trevor,
actually just a Tommy Slattery or whatever his name is. I was all about that, and I really enjoyed that. And like, I love that when he comes out of the bathroom and he's like, don't go in there for 20 minutes. I was like, this is a Shane Black movie. Shane Black is doing everything in his power to make this a Shane Black movie. Mm-hmm. And like, I was into it. I really was. And it was pretty much when the house collapsed from that point on, I was like, what are the rules? Where am I? Why is there so much convenience? What's going on? And the Ben Kingsley thing happened and I was into it. And then the third act happened, and that's why it landed at 2.5 and not 3. And the Shane Black elements were just good enough that I had to give it more than 2. Because I did really what I need to retcon, as the kids say, because I gave Iron Man 2.5 stars.
Yeah.
And this I enjoyed more than Iron Man 2. So I had to give this 2.5 stars at least. Right. But in reality, Iron Man 2 probably should be a 2-star movie, and this can still stay at 2.5, but this is, you know, whatever. I enjoyed this enough. It didn't feel like it insulted me. It also had some of my favorite people in it, so that also can help. I love Guy Pierce. You know, for anybody who knows me, with LA Confidential, you know, that is one of my all-time favorite movies. I also think the movie The Proposition is like a masterpiece. I'm a big Guy Pierce fan. I don't think he's in nearly enough movies. So that helped. Ben Kingsley, I'm a big fan of. I think Ben Kingsley, if you've never seen Sexy Beast, Ben Kingsley's performance in Sexy Beast is insane. He's great. I like that stuff. I like clever writing. This felt like it was trying to turn the superhero movie into a into like a new school neo-noir. Like I really yeah. enjoyed that until it stopped doing that. And then it just devolves into the nonsense. And I think ultimately what stopped me from watching these movies in the first place wasn't just that The Avengers is one of the worst movies I've ever seen. And I'm going to keep saying that to piss off the Avengers people. It was, they all follow the exact same structure.
Yeah.
And I at least respect in Iron Man 3 that they really do have Tony Stark lose everything. Mm-hmm. Like they have him lose, he loses his house, he loses Jarvis, he loses his little robots, he loses so much. And I really respect that they went that route. But it's always unfortunate because you know at the end it's going to be some big fight battle scene. And The Dark Knight, which was in my last iteration of my top 100, doesn't have that. And that's why I love The Dark Knight, because the little battle with the Joker at the end is like non-existent. Yeah. This just feels like the same ending as every other movie, except this time Guy Pearce breathes fire.
It does. And I think a lot of this has come with like, again, I think we're like at the point where studio interference is a big thing in the Marvel movies. This is, remember, the first movie that was actually fully made under the Disney banner. Because Avengers was made previously, and then the Disney acquisition happened for distribution of the movie. But this is the first one that's like actually factually like a Disney movie, which is funny because it is so dark.
Yeah, it is.
Movie gets darker ones. Dark. There is a point where a woman like thrusts her arm through someone's torso and gets a gun and shoots another person.
Mm-hmm.
It gets dark, and I think the darkness is necessary for kind of the unfortunate twist at the end of this movie where Pepper ends up being alive.
Yeah.
Because it makes you believe Pepper could actually have died.
Yeah. I actually, when she fell into that, I was like, oh, I didn't realize maybe she just wanted to be written out of the movies. Then it was like, and I was like, oh, that's right. She's going to have the fire ability. She's fine because she's been pumped with it. So she'll be good. And then very neatly with the bow. Now she's totally fine. And Tony loses his heart thing and blah, 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 yada, yada, yada.
Yeah. There was one point in the movie where Tony finally gets like the shrapnel removed from his heart.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, man, is the American medical system just so bad that like, rather than doing this 6 years or like, what was it? 4 years ago that Tony just waited until this point to remove the shrapnel. Wouldn't that have just solved like literally every problem he has been having until now?
No, he doesn't have time for it, John. He's so tired because he's always working and doing stuff. He's Iron Man. He doesn't have time to get open heart surgery.
Oh, of course. My bad. It's not like he could afford the best open heart surgeons in the world.
I mean, he could, but it's still, I mean, recovery, it doesn't matter how good your open heart surgeon is. Recovery is going to take some time. And I think he needed to like really go, he needed to protect Pepper. How can he go get open heart surgery when there's bad guys out there who want to kill the only thing that he has to live for?
Maybe he shouldn't have openly declared his identity to everyone at the end of the first movie then.
Or maybe in this one, he shouldn't give his exact address in what could be the like one of my least favorite parts of any movie. See, that's where like this movie just, it was a roller coaster. But like that scene, he gives his address and they like blow it up. And I'm like, that was how they determined. Like I get his arrogance is what gets him, but like, come on.
I would say it's hubris more than anything, but
hubris. That's what I meant. I mean, my wife said arrogance and I said hubris to her. So, you know.
There we go. But yes, but also I'm pretty sure everyone already knows where Tony Stark lives if they really want to know.
I mean, it's a pretty obvious house. It's not like he lives in a little one story, three bedroom, two bathroom.
Yeah, exactly. One thing I really disliked about this movie is when Killian comes in and it's like showing the brain off to Pepper and everything. And it's like pitching Extremis to her. And Happy's calls Tony and talks about the sketchy guy. The problem is like at that point, we already know the sketchy bald guy is like associated with Killian. So we already know Killian's the bad guy at that point when we start following him. And like we get to the Chinese theater and everything, right?
Yeah, I mean, we already know Killian's the bad guy because at the beginning of the movie, Tony Stark stands him up.
Sure. I mean, I guess that is the easiest way to do it.
Yeah.
But I wish there was a bit of like a sowing of disbelief there so that we didn't quite know who it was.
I also feel like
more of the whodunit to it. More of the Neil Noir,
James Badge Dale isn't acting all that creepy or weird.
No, I think he's just kind of like being a dick.
It seems like he's sitting there waiting for his boss to come out. That's all.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
He's not acting weird at all.
Ah, so what we're admitting now is Happy Hogan is one of the worst characters in the MCU.
Happy Hogan sucks. I do like, though, that in the flashback in this one, he makes it so that he looks like John Travolta in Pulp Fiction. I did respect that because we know that Jon Favreau is a massive fan of Quentin Tarantino. Swingers, he does the Reservoir Dogs walk. But yeah, in this one, he tries to make himself look like John Travolta. And I just think, like, I get he didn't write and direct this one, but at this point, Jon Favreau had such an impact on these movies that he was making creative decisions still. And so good for you.
Well, yeah,
makes yourself really cool.
Yeah. But I think like Shane, I think Shane Black is the best natural progression from Jon Favreau's humor in
this
character. I think it really was like, I think Shane Black was a really good choice. Now, do I think Disney would hire Shane Black to direct this movie? No, I'm pretty sure this was a Robert Downey Jr. pulling a lot of strings to get his friend to do it.
Absolutely.
And like, again, like I said at the beginning of the top of the podcast, like this is a movie that has so much potential that's just squandered because it has superhero formula. And I complained about it with Iron Man 2, how they didn't go into Tony's alcoholism enough. They don't go into the PTSD a lot here. It's hinted at a lot. Obviously, we have the panic attacks and everything. We have the fact that he's suffering from insomnia to the point where he has created, the Mark 7? In the Avengers? Was that the one that he had just made? The Mark 7?
I think, and now it's 42, right?
He made 35 new suits of armor.
Yeah.
Since the events of the Avengers, which is like a couple of months. So,
yeah.
Like, it's there. There are these pieces for it to build on. It just never goes all the way. It never has him discuss it. It never has him, like, discussing his, like, mortality at all. When he, like, literally went through a wormhole into space, saw an entire invasion fleet of aliens, and almost died.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, like, it's addressed, but it's not dug into enough to really be impactful to what's happening in the film.
They just keep calling it New York, New York, New York. And yeah, it's, like, I didn't really gather from the end of the Avengers that this was this traumatic of an experience for Tony Stark.
Exactly.
They don't address that. And I mean, that goes back to Joss Whedon just being a terrible writer, but like, they don't make it seem like Tony Stark, like he got to be the hero. Like, that's awesome. He came back, he lived, whatever. Like, it doesn't seem like it's that big of a deal. And then they make it like it's so much bigger of a deal. And it's the whole premise of this movie. And I do think, you know what I think the biggest problem is like the Marvel movies almost need to be treated like a TV show. They knew they were going to keep making them. They knew that it was going to keep going. And you knew that one was going to have to lead into the other. You knew that there was going to have to be relevance from one to the next. And I mean, with a TV show, when you do season one of Lost, you don't know you're getting six seasons. So there might be a little bit of a detachment there. By the time you hit season three, four, five, six, they know that they're getting more seasons. So you start to plant seeds for later on. And everybody always goes, Lost didn't know where it was going. Well, yeah, in episode one, if they plant something, you can't expect that they absolutely knew where that was going to go because they didn't know how many episodes they were going to get. But with the Marvel movies at this point, they knew they were doing phase two. Thor 2 was coming out later that year. They knew so much was going on. And so why are they not already planning like exactly the storyline for the next movie ahead of time? And if they are already planning it, why are they not making sure that it's tighter? Because if they knew, okay, Iron Man 3 is going to be a PTSD movie, well, then you should know that when you're making the Avengers. It was less than a year earlier.
Yeah, it's a big question of like, I don't know if they did know phase two was happening when they finished writing the Avengers. Because again, the Disney acquisition happened. I think that changed things.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I don't know. Because like, if you look at the Avengers, it could be this nice tidy bow on everything. Mm-hmm. But like, we know it isn't. And we know that it does continue. So I don't blame them so much for that. It's just because I think you can tell all the PTSD stuff in just this movie. I don't think you need to hint at it in the Avengers to do that. Mm-hmm. Mainly because, like, Tony also is the type of person to put on a brave face, which is what we see him doing here too, right? Like, we see that persona from Tony. The problem is like, there's literally a point where this kid's like, well, just don't let it bother you. And it just stops bothering him.
Yeah. Yep. And I think that's more like, it doesn't need to be like so overplayed, but like, if that is what it's going to be, there should be some sort of hint. And then even if there's not, they should spend more time focusing on in this movie, because there's a lot of assumption that we'll just know that Tony Stark is struggling. And I almost was like, wait, what happened in New York? Because then also at the beginning of this movie, the flashback is to something way earlier. It was way, way earlier. Like, he's not saying, oh, my demons are that I went and did this. Like, the ending of the Avengers is almost overshadowed because they need to introduce Guy Pearce and Rebecca Hall, which, by the way, Rebecca Hall, one of the greatest actresses ever that gets no freaking credit. I love her. She makes some bad film decisions, but if you've never seen the movie, Christine, not the Stephen King movie about the car, but the movie about the first person to ever kill themselves on TV, you should watch that movie, because that movie is absolutely brilliant. But, and she's the best, but all that aside, they overshadow what the actual story of the movie is so that they can introduce the other characters. So then when it's like, oh, Tony Stark's having nightmares and having a hard time, I'm like, over Guy Pearce having a cane? Over Rebecca Hall? Like, what? Like, it's too much of a jump for me.
Well, the entire point of that opening sequence is to set up the Extravis of it all and not the Tony of it all, right? Like,
yeah.
Like, I guess we're supposed to see Tony behaving in a way which makes Killian like become this evil person or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think this is one of those instances where showing a villain origin story really harms the film.
Yeah.
Because we were talking about how, like, in The Nun, you need motive. You need motive in these movies, but sometimes people can just be bad.
Yeah.
Right? Like, it's a superhero movie. The motivation, at least give us you can give us a motivation, but making like this personal vendetta when it wasn't really a personal vendetta in the film, like the rest of the film, right? Yeah. It just makes it a little cloudy and confusing.
No, that's a really good point, because it really isn't a personal vendetta at all. It is like, it is, but like, he didn't go and build this thing and start to do all this great stuff just to get back at Tony Stark.
No, not at all. Like, it's more like this opening sequence is to introduce us to these two characters and Extremis itself, right? With the plant and everything. Yep. And then, like, so that we know what it is further along. So we know when Rebecca Hall shows up again later, we're like, oh, yeah, you're the person who created this. You should be helping. And then we get the twist that she's actually evil. And then we get the other twist that Guy Pearce doesn't care about her at all and shoots her. And, like, it builds there. It's great. Like, again, like those are the Shane Black elements of it. But when we look at the superhero elements of it, it just feels really like a bit bland, I guess, is the best way to put it.
Yeah, it's almost like those two things were competing and they were butting heads. And like, when you look at the Dark Knight trilogy that Christopher Nolan makes, it's Christopher Nolan making superhero movies, but he has all of the control there. He is the one who is controlling the direction of the story. And he's also like, his style isn't getting in the way of the superhero element, but the superhero element isn't so overpowering that it's getting in the way of his style. Yep. Shane Black has such a distinct, specific style that it is a little bit getting in the way of the superhero elements, but then the superhero elements ultimately get in the way of Shane Black's style. Shane Black, this was never going to be a 4-star movie because Shane Black was never going to be able to make the movie that he wanted to make.
Yeah.
And it couldn't go the Captain America First Avenger route, which still to this point is my favorite of these movies, because Shane Black's style was always going to conflict with what was happening in the superhero world. So while it's a good decision, ultimately, because it does add more fun and different elements to it, it creates a very middling movie, which ultimately is how I felt about most of the Marvel movies to this point. Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really interesting, because I think, like, as we move forward, we're really going to see that with, like, the directors that are chosen for these movies. We are going to get to one in phase two where the director, like, infamously changed in the movie. And, like, it kind of changed a lot of like the direction things were going and stuff. But if we look at the direction we have moving forward, next week we're covering Thor. Kenneth Branagh is not back to direct that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then the week after that, we have Captain America, Winter Soldier, which is the Russo brothers, who were TV guys at that point, right? Like, mm-hmm. we see the direction that they went with these, like, I guess we had Favreau, and then we had, I don't even remember who did Incredible Hulk, and then we had Branagh, and we had Joe Jackson, and Joss Whedon, and then we had Shane Black, and now it's like, okay, maybe we don't want to put these directors here because they want too much control.
Well, and I think that's a fair thing, and I think that circles all the way back to the first movie we talked about tonight, which was The Nun 2. Mm-hmm. I do think that a lot of times these studios want to put somebody who's not established, who they can control every decision they make in the director's chair. We've heard about it with Alien 3 for the last 30 years, about how David Fincher had no control over what was happening in that movie, and it created a disaster, and they butted heads. And sometimes you get these big names, and that might help you if you really need to start a franchise or something. But when you're already established, you want somebody who's going to come in and play by the rules. You don't want somebody who's going to come in and change the rules. The rules are already good. So that's where they get these new directors, or directors that weren't anything until they made one of these movies, and they try to do that with them. And that's the same thing, like I talked about it with Disney with Haunted Mansion. They'll try to bring in, Disney will try to bring in a director who is not established to make a movie. If the movie's a flop, that director's career is over. Who gives a damn? Disney will continue on. If the movie's a success, well, now Disney has a director they've worked with whose name they can throw around as like, ooh, they were the director of this, when they're on to something else. And Disney knows that that director is going to do what they want them to do. It's getting rid of the auteur aspect of film, which is a real shame. But also, like, you kind of have to have one of these big budget superhero kind of movies on your resume at this point to be making the type of money you want to be making as a director.
Well, that's the thing. It's like, you have to make these movies to make the movies you want to make.
Yeah.
Right? Like even if we look at, like, well, I can't think of a good example at the moment, but, like, we look at these bigger name direct, like, these, we look at some of these people who have, like, or, okay, I actually do have an answer. Like, we look at Ari Aster. We've mentioned him already today. He made, obviously, he made two movies he wanted to make in Hereditary and Midsommar, but he then, because of the success of those, got like carte blanche when it came to Bo is Afraid, which I know is a very divisive film for a lot of people, but like that was Ari Aster being like, I have complete creative control over this movie.
Yep.
And like part of what you have to do as a director in Hollywood is direct something to get enough attention on you so that your name just carries enough weight that people stop paying attention to you.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a brutal little system that has been established here. And it's unfortunate. Like, you know, but there's really nothing that you can do about it. I mean, that's just kind of how it is. And Raptor 8415, I wonder if we'll see the return of auteurs after the franchise era of film we're in runs its course. Who knows?
I mean, we still have auteurs though, right? Like we do,
but I do feel like Ari Aster, even though he's an auteur and he's done this, and God, I always forget his name, John, your boy who did The Lighthouse and everything.
Robert Eggers.
Thank you, Robert Eggers. Like, these are auteurs. Like, these are guys like that. But they're not elevating to the level of a Paul Thomas Anderson right now. Like at least in terms of, like, a fame level. They'll have these movies that are discussed in certain circles, but they're not hitting that level yet. And that's what concerns me more, and like that's what I'm curious about moving forward, because man, anybody can make The Nun 2. I could have went and directed The Nun 2. Like, I'm serious. I could have directed any of them, because it's not hard to do that. Okay, stand here and then move the camera. Okay, but it's so easy. Like, I'm sorry, but like, I respect directors and I respect writers and like I respect actors and stuff. Anybody could direct The Nun 2. Anybody could direct The Nun. Like, these are very easy to direct movies. Iron Man 3, not anybody could direct it the way that Shane Black directed it.
Yeah.
But anybody could direct this movie.
Yes.
If they just wanted the standard whatever. So, you know, it's
yeah, I think that is what makes this like stand out a little bit more along among especially these early MCU movies, is this definitely feels like a director's movie. It's kind of like the way that like Thor stands out as like a Kenneth Branagh movie. This stands out as a Shane Black movie. But we're just starting to see that like directors don't have full control over these franchises.
Yeah. Nope, for sure. You're right. Well, next week, which I didn't talk to you yet, but can you do Thursday next week? We'll do this live.
Yep.
Okay, we're going to do Thursday because we're podcasting with Peridium anyway, so we'll do Thursday. We're doing A Haunting in Venice and Thor the Dark World, and I'm very pleased to report that A Haunting in Venice is getting pretty strong reviews.
Well, speaking of Kenneth Branagh.
I know. I'm excited. I really am. Go ahead.
I'm very excited. I mean, I already gushed about Kenneth Branagh on this podcast, and I get to do it again next week with an acting role and directing role. I'm really excited.
Yeah, I'm actually, as soon as we're done here, I'm going to go watch, Death on the Nile. I just watched Murder on the Orient Express the other day. It's entertaining. I enjoyed it. Kenneth Branagh's having fun with it. You know, put the big stars in there, do whatever. It's not all that different from the original. It's a little different, but not much. But I'm into it. Like, I really enjoyed it. And I'm excited to watch Death on the Nile. And A Haunting in Venice is getting really solid reviews. It's been a while since we've done a good movie in theaters. So that will be super exciting. And then Thor the Dark World, which I don't think I'm going to like that much, but I'm trying not to, convince myself.
I'm 100% confident. I have seen this movie once, and I was in theaters, and I've never seen it again.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll see.
There you go.
I'm excited to revisit it. It's just awkward that I'm seeing something directed by Kenneth Branagh, and then this successor to a Kenneth Branagh film. It's going to be really interesting to compare the two.
Yeah. So we'll be talking about those next Thursday night. Make sure to tune in for that. Also, I was just looking at box office numbers. The Nun 2 made $32.6 million. Yeah, but that's pretty good. It's unfortunate because its budget looks like it was about $38 million. So it's already almost made its money back in the U.S. It's made about $88 million worldwide, so it's a shame.
Is that the biggest opening weekend we've had since Barbie and Oppenheimer?
Yeah, I mean, it killed it. It finally displaced Barbie, but I do think it makes sense. I think a lot of the people who were probably revisiting Barbie are probably people who will go watch a horror movie in theaters. Yeah. And so, finally, it's like, okay, I'll go see this instead of that. And The Nun 2 is something you're more likely to go see than Last Voyage of the Demeter. So, simple. But yeah, $32.6 million. My Big Fat Greek Wedding opened third. So it couldn't even top Equalizer 3. So it seems like this will be the final Big Fat Greek Wedding. That's it. We'll be back next Thursday. Tune in. And yeah, hopefully you guys enjoy A Haunting in Venice more than The Nun 2. And if you enjoyed The Nun 2 more, just please don't tell me you like The Nun.